we have with us live in the studios. Once again, Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning. He's out.
He's struggling with an illness this morning. Hopefully he'll get better over the weekend, but, he's just taking some time to rest.
All right. Let's start out with the one local story we have for today, and that would be something that would have been very hard to miss with a lot of media coverage on it. It's the shooting done by Maurice Clemens.
Yeah, of the four Lakewood police officers in a coffee shop last Sunday. Maurice Clemens was shot by a single police officer on Tuesday. And of course, afterwards, the police department announced that they had conveniently found a handgun belonging to one of the dead cops in Clemens' pocket after he was shot. There was no mention that he had threatened the officer, just that the officer recognized him and then asked him to raise his hands or give up or whatever. And Clemens, who it was pretty clear was going through some pretty severe mental health problems, either didn't hear or he didn't comply, and then he was shot. So one of the things that isn't being covered a whole lot in the media here locally is that, as I said, Clemens was going through some serious mental health problems, and that there was no indication that he was getting any help at all through Washington State's courts or criminal justice system when he was jailed, both in May and in July, when it was pretty clear that he was having mental health problems. And that's becoming a really common story here in Washington State, whether we're talking about people who are released into the community to go on a shooting spree, as happened earlier this year, or a guy who was released to live in a halfway house who wasn't taking his meds and wasn't being checked by community mental health officers and wasn't actually living at the halfway house where he was supposed to be at, and ended up stabbing a woman on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day, I can't remember which.
I can't remember either.
It's becoming a common story that we want to place the blame on Arkansas's broken parole system. We want to put the blame on former Governor Mike Huckabee of Arkansas, but you know, we got to look at our own system and what we did wrong. And here in Washington State, it's pretty clear that this man should have had some treatment, should have been getting some help. He was a violent offender. He had a history of carrying weapons with him and of assaulting people. He was a clear danger to other people, and something should have been done, and it wasn't. Also, another aspect of this story that people kind of puzzle over is, why did his relatives and his friends help him out? Well, I mean, look at it this way. Here's an African-American man who had a history of being railroaded by the criminal justice system in Arkansas. As a juvenile, as a 17-year-old, he was sentenced to more than 100 years in prison for burglary and a mugging. And for carrying a weapon to his high school. I mean, these are not offenses that would have gotten him anywhere near that amount of time if he'd been a white offender. He was clearly railroaded because of his race in Arkansas. And, he'd been spending months in and out of jail and the courts here in Washington leading up to this crime, where he clearly hadn't been getting any help at all. So, you know, and he shot four police officers. That puts a target on your forehead. So, you know, is it any wonder his relatives and his friends, who all spoke highly of him before he had his mental health breakdown, is it any wonder that they were worried about what would happen to him if he tried to turn himself in, or if they tried to call the police and turn him in? So it's not a mystery why his relatives and his friends tried to help him. The mystery is, why wasn't something done earlier to help this man who was clearly having mental health problems?
All right. Moving on to national, and starting with some reports that have come out.
Yeah, there were three separate reports this week released by three very different agencies regarding how the U.S. justice system treats immigrants who are held in detention. many of these legal immigrants. The three agencies that released the reports varied from Human Rights Watch, which routinely issues reports about the U.S. justice system and our treatment, particularly of people of color, but also the Constitution Project, which is a nonprofit group that's run by a bipartisan group of folks, some who are on, who are liberals and some who are conservatives. And the Homeland Security Department's Inspector General released a report too, and they all reached similar conclusions that non-citizens, including legal immigrants, as I said before, who are being held in detention often unnecessarily. They're being transferred needlessly, often halfway across the country or further, where they get lost in the system, and then because they're separated from relatives, from legal counsel, from their friends and their communities of support, they lack the evidence that they need to prove that they shouldn't be in detention and that they don't need to be deported. So they're often deported, that they're not automatically provided legal counsel, that about 1.4 million detainees have been transferred around the country from 1999 to 2008, and most of those folks were transferred, have been transferred since 2006. So most of those transfers have taken place just in the last 2 years, and that the number of detainees are being transferred have increased dramatically just very recently. And it has nothing to do with the increased number of detainees, that in fact the transfers have increased, even though the number of detainees have not increased that quickly. So more than 442,000 people are being detained each year, and that's more than double the number that were detained in 2003. And the recommendations from these reports, just kind of combining them all together, include things like detainees need to be told immediately, given notice immediately of why they're being held. So you can't, the U.S. justice system needs to end the practice of scooping up people, holding them for weeks or months without telling them why they're being held. They need to end most transfers because most of these transfers are unnecessary. They need to provide free counsel, including government-paid lawyers, to detainees as soon as possible. That's probably not going to happen, but that's something that really needs to happen, particularly for folks who hold visas and are considered legal immigrants, but also folks who don't and need help just navigating the justice system. And that immigration judges should have the discretion to appoint counsel and to require lawyers to be appointed, particularly for children who are unaccompanied, who don't have an adult with them, and for the mentally ill who don't have the ability to request or try to scramble to get a lawyer or legal counsel to represent them. And of course, the U.S. justice system should end unnecessary detentions of particularly legal immigrants, but also folks who are not legal, who are nonviolent.
All right. Moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, there was some so-called good news in the economy this week. It included the retail sales report was released, which covered for November, which covered spending over the Thanksgiving weekend, which is usually when most retailers they go into the black, which is why it's called Black Friday, that day after Thanksgiving. It's when most retailers make up their money for the year. If they haven't been doing so well prior to November, November is when they make their sales targets. But there was some, and what the report showed was that spending over that weekend was about the same as last year, which was spun as good news. However, last year sales had dropped so precipitously from prior years that I don't see that necessarily as good news. I see it as sort of hidden bad news that the economy is not really recovering. And when you look at the details, that sort of plays out. Average spending per person actually fell this year from the prior year, and prior year it was pretty bad. The difference between last year and this year was made up by more people taking advantage of doorbusters, those really severely discounted items that are put on sale early, very early in the morning on the day after Thanksgiving in order to lure shoppers in the door. So it's not at all clear that even though sales volume was the same as last year, that stores will be making as much of a profit as they did last year. That's not at all clear. So there's some hidden bad news in that good news report. The other report I want to talk about is the jobs report. The Labor Department report for November showed a smaller decline in the number of jobs than in previous months, supposedly in November. Now, these are just early statistics. They often get revised later. Only 11,000 jobs were lost. Again, there was not a net gain in the number of jobs in the economy last month. There was just less of a drop than we've had in previous months. But that means that it's being spun as positive news, because the official unemployment number went from 10.2% to about 10% last month. So there was a little drop in the official unemployment number. But again, there's some hidden bad news in there. Fewer people are looking for work. The size of the labor force has dropped by 1.2 million people over the last 6 months. So that's not good news. That means that more of the unemployed are losing their benefits and are giving up looking for a new job. So people are becoming discouraged and they're dropping out of the job market. That's accounting for a large drop in the unemployment, the official unemployment figure. That's not a positive piece of news. So that's kind of what passes for good news these days, a retail sales report that's not really a good report, and a jobs report that's showing that much of the drop in official unemployment is being caused by people just giving up looking for work. That's not really good news.
Well, that's one sector of the economy, apparently, that still has jobs, is the public relations sector, that keeps trying to spin this into positive light.
Clearly, or I don't know, media pundits who talk about the economy, sort of like me, except I don't get paid for this.
Right.
Anyway, so Obama this week, to try to put a positive spin on the whole jobs thing, he held his jobs summit on Thursday at the White House with about 130 people invited to attend the jobs summit to discuss ways that the Obama administration can help the economy create jobs. The attendees were a mixed bunch. It didn't include the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which, the media made a big deal about, Obama is snubbing the U.S. Chamber of Commerce because they're not on board the health care reform and they don't agree with his climate change legislation. But, he did include a whole bunch of other folks who got to give them their say, including a bunch of economists, some small business owners, a few union leaders, but also a lot of corporate executives who I'm sure got their point across, and as well or better than the trade organization, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who usually represents them. And so, of course, they came away with some interesting ideas, the usual bad ideas, including what I think is pretty preposterous, a cash for caulkers program, which is supposed to subsidize people who would weatherize their homes. I think that's a giveaway to upper middle class and wealthy people, because it's really okay to have that kind of a program if you own your home, and really okay if you aren't already maxed out on your finances trying to pay your mortgage, which is not true for most people. And I don't really understand how that's going to create a lot of jobs, but some other of their bad ideas included expanding financing for export businesses, which, of course, that's the business lobby talking there, and sort of a vague proposal about more infrastructure spending with no associated ideas for how government would be able to finance that when we have a record deficit. Of course, nobody mentioned that we could get banks to pay back their bailout money. That might help finance some infrastructure spending. In the news this week, there was some banking news, including Bank of America coming forward and saying, we do want to pay back our bailout money. Of course, it isn't necessarily because Bank of America is doing really well. It's because Bank of America is hunting for a new CEO. And in order to attract the kind of CEO they want, they want to pay back their bailout money so that the federal government isn't telling them what they can offer for executive compensation. So, of course, you know, you look at that and you go, okay, if the incentive is to get out from under the government's thumb in terms of what you can offer for executive compensation, it means Bank of America wants to go back to the bad old practice of offering too much money for some guy who's going to come in and do the same old risky practices that got them into trouble in the first place. And this comes in a week when the FDIC, just yesterday, closed five more banks. Most of them small banks, but as it happens, they closed a regional bank that was the fourth largest bank failure this year. And that's going to cost the FDIC bailout fund another $2 billion. And that just puts the total number of bank failures this year at 130 and rising. So that's the economic news for this week.
All right. Well, then that takes us over to international news, and starting with President Obama's speech on Afghanistan.
Yeah, you know, that was the big news going into this week, and the big news all this week was Obama's announcement of his surge coming on the heels of the Bush administration surge in Iraq. And much of the Afghan surge is being, you know, patterned after that Iraq surge. But as some pundits have pointed out, the situation in Afghanistan is nowhere near the same as the situation in Iraq was. So just the details of Obama's announcement, and I went through and I read his speech because I wanted to really understand. There's a difference between listening to the speech and actually reading it, the text, and getting an idea of understanding what exactly is in the proposal. So I went and I read it, and I wanted to understand the details. He's talking really about 30,000 additional troops. That's going to bring the total U.S. troops in Afghanistan up to about 100,000, which is very close to what we have in Iraq. And he says in the speech that in 18 months we will begin a withdrawal. That's being proposed, that's being called a timeline for success in Afghanistan, but saying that in 18 months you're going to begin a withdrawal is not quite the same as saying we're going to be out of Afghanistan in 18 months. That beginning the withdrawal can mean just about anything you want it to, and of course beginning is not necessarily completing withdrawal. So
yeah, I know Robert Gates was interviewed this week, Secretary of Defense, and he clarified that
there is no timeline.
That's beginning the process.
Yes,
leaves it pretty wide open.
That leaves it very wide open. And of course, Obama talked about a little bit about what those 30,000 additional troops are going to do. And he said, and these are his exact words in his speech, he said they will secure key population centers. However, the media quickly went to military leaders in the Pentagon and in Afghanistan, and they said, oh, really? What are those 30,000 troops going to do? And it became very clear that those 30,000 troops are not going to key population centers. Those 30,000, the bulk of those troops are going to be going to Helmand province and to Kandahar province, into areas that have been largely depopulated by the ongoing war in Afghanistan. So the bulk of those troops, about three quarters of them, are going to be going to do the same old bad policy that hasn't worked. And then about a quarter, maybe a little less than a quarter, of those troops are going to supposedly train competent Afghan security forces to take over from us. Now, if you mention to people who have been stationed in Afghanistan or military commanders who are over there on the ground in Afghanistan, if you say the term competent Afghan security forces, they tend to laugh because Afghan security forces largely either don't exist, they're fake names on a payroll, or they tend to be corrupt police officers. The Afghans police forces are so corrupt that that reporters routinely point out, who cover Afghanistan, routinely point out that in order to get the position of a police commander, usually those positions are auctioned off to the highest bidder. So already you're paying to get the position. And then once you get it, you turn around and you use that job in order to participate in the widespread narcotics trade in Afghanistan. It's often pointed out in the U.S. media that the Taliban largely profit from the narcotics trade. It's not often pointed out that the Afghan government, including the Afghan police force, have a large hand in drug smuggling out of the country, and that they also profit from the narcotics trade. And so, of course, Obama mentioned, well, we have to clean up corruption in the Karzai government, and to do that, he proposed, he didn't say it outright, but he said kind of vaguely that he was going to funnel support to local governors and local officials in Afghanistan. In other words, bypass Karzai's central government to try to strengthen local governments. But hey, that's where a lot of the drug running is going on, is these local governments outside of the central government in Kabul. So that didn't make me feel like anything was going to be accomplished there in cleaning up corruption in Afghanistan. In addition, Obama said that he wants a commitment of more help from NATO allies, and NATO allies came forward and said, oh gosh, yeah, we're gonna be sending 7,000 additional troops to Afghanistan, but those are not additional troops. 2,000 of those troops are already in the country, and 5,000 of those troops are gonna go to replace about 5,000 NATO troops that are going back to their home countries anyway in the next year. So that's actually maintaining the status quo number of NATO ally forces in the country. It's not a 7,000 troop increase at all. And so that's, nothing's really happening on that front either, even though that's a major part of Obama's strategy to sort of win the peace in Afghanistan. What also bothers me is that it's not said explicitly in his speech, but U.S. officials have told reporters at the New York Times and the Washington Post that as part of the Obama surge strategy, much of the money that's going to be going into Afghanistan is going to be going to arm and train local militias in villages and in smaller population centers or around smaller population centers in eastern and southern Afghanistan. This is mirroring what the Bush administration did in the Sunni areas of Iraq. The really big problem with this strategy in Afghanistan is that you don't have nearly as many disaffected people wanting to fight foreign al-Qaeda forces in Afghanistan as you did in Iraq. Al-Qaeda forces are not as prominent in the fight in Afghanistan. The Taliban is who we're fighting in Afghanistan, and the Taliban are locally based. They're from eastern Afghanistan and western Pakistan, and many of the people that we call Taliban that we're fighting in Afghanistan are local villagers who just want us out of there, who are sick of 8 years of war and want us to leave. So that's a major way in which Afghanistan is very different from Iraq, and it's going to impact the ability for the Obama administration to duplicate what they, you know, in Afghanistan, what the Bush administration did in Iraq. So that's one major problem with Obama's surge. And then the last major part of his strategy was his quote unquote closer partnership with Pakistan that the Obama administration is always talking about. In other words, vague promise of long-term aid to the government of Pakistan and the Pakistani military. And he had some tough talk in his speech about getting Pakistan to go after the Afghan Taliban, which they haven't shown any signs of wanting to do at all up to this point. But there are two things that came to light this week that weren't in Obama's speech that reporters from the New York Times and Washington Post pointed out. One of them is that the White House this week authorized an expansion of the CIA's program of drone flights and bombings in western Pakistan, going after Al-Qaeda bigwigs and others, and that, you know, of course, this wasn't pointed out in the media that these are illegal assassinations inside of a country we're not at war with, and that these drone attacks are wildly unpopular in Pakistan. The other development in Pakistan that happened last week was that Pakistan's elected president, Asif Ali Zardari, who is Benazir Bhutto's husband, his popularity levels are at an all-time low, and last week he turned over control of Pakistan's nuclear arsenal to Prime Minister Yousaf Raza Gilani, who is has much closer connections to Pakistan's military. And this is primarily because Pakistan's military does not trust Zardari and just hates him with a passion. What this means is that the elected president of Pakistan no longer has much of a control over the government as he did when he was first elected, and that the U.S. is now going to be supporting and has already said that they have more support for the Pakistani military than for the civilian elected government. So what we're doing by saying we want to give long-term support for Pakistan's military is we're saying we prefer having a military dictatorship in Pakistan. We prefer a move that is going to weaken its civilian government, and we want things to go back to the way they were when General Musharraf was in power in Pakistan. So that's a major side effect of the Obama surge in Afghanistan.
All right. Let's move on briefly to India and decisions they're making regarding climate change.
Yeah, India announced this week that they are setting emissions targets, and their emissions targets are even less stiff than the Chinese. Instead of cutting total emissions like China, they are going to cut their growth in emissions. China announced last week that they would cut their growth in carbon emissions by about 50%, by about between 40 and 50%. India announced this week that they were going to cut it by about 20 to 25%. And again, these are based on 2005 levels, which are much higher than the 1990 levels specified in the Kyoto Treaty. And I also want to point out that both China and India can easily meet these targets with no change in the status quo in their countries.
All right. That leaves us some time for upcoming events.
Yeah, we had some upcoming events this next week. At 2 p.m. today at Westlake Park at 4th and Pine, there's going to be a protest of Obama's surge in Afghanistan. This event's endorsed by ANSWER, IVAW, Iraq Veterans Against the War, Sound Nonviolent Opponents of War, et cetera, and other groups support it as well. So if you're not appalled by the recent cold snap, you should layer up and go out and support protest against the surge in Afghanistan.
I'm sorry,
at 2 p.m. today at Westlake Park. And Lehigh Low Income Housing Institute is having their punk rock flea market today. You can check that out at 2407 First Avenue in Belltown. That goes from noon today until midnight. And then on Tuesday, there's going to be a premiere showing of Turning Point. That's a documentary produced by the vendor staff and volunteers at Real Change Newspaper. That's going to be at Trinity United Methodist Church from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday. That's 6512 23rd Avenue Northwest in Ballard.
Very good. All right. Talking with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State, and tell us, where do people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State around town in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, places where you find free newspapers. We're also in the King County Public Library System. You can also find us online at www.eatthestate.org.